This is Chapter 3, Hill of the Ravens, by Harold Covington. At about 5 o'clock that evening, Don Redman arrived back at his home on a rolling rural road just south of Tumwater. It was a cheery old house set in a copse of Douglas fir, cherry trees, and fragrant cedar, sporting blue with white trim on the modern, weatherproof siding Don had installed when the old oak clapboard had finally gotten too moldy to keep on with. He slid his electric ground car silently into the garage alongside his wife's methane truck and Alan's alcohol-burning motorcycle, which Don kept tuned and cleaned, awaiting for his son to come home and space to ride it again. Not a single petroleum engine existed anywhere in the Republic anymore, in any military or civilian vehicle. Every visitor to the Northwest came away with one memory above all, the clear blue of the sky and the fresh sweetness of the air. The structure was a big one for a typically large Northwest family, originally built in the 1920s as a farmhouse. Don and Sarah had bought the place free and clear with one of the Republic's first life grants for newly married couples. In the Republic, there had never been mortgages with their crushing interest of the kind that had drained the financial lifeblood from generations of American homeowners. The traditional household, with the bread-winning husband and the father as the head of the family, and the wife and mother as the heart, had once more become reality in the Northwest. Over the years, Don had added rooms and refurbished the old barn in the back as a playhouse and a rec room in which the kids had spent a large amount of their childhood. Don got out of the car and closed the garage door. He turned and saw a large dark shape approaching. "Hello, Bakersville," he said. Bakersville woofed once in greeting. He was one of the larger specimens of the Guelph canines, the genetically engineered attack and security dogs. Don preferred the black Labrador breed over the German Shepherd and Doberman models. Super intelligent for a dog, his internal microchip set to respond to voice commands only from the Redmond family or from John Morgan, Bakersville was a guardian for the family more efficient and deadly than any electronic or alarm system. He could sense any intruder and respond with proactive ferocity. He helped make it possible for them to live a normal life. The United States Office of Northwest Recovery had tried to murder Don Redmond on 3 occasions in the past 10 years. Don killed 2 of the federal assassins in the field. Sarah, his wife, had killed a third when the American got into the house in Don's absence, shooting him between the eyes as he attempted to lift the sleeping toddler John from his crib, possibly to use as a hostage or human shield as he waited for Don to come home. It was after this incident that Bakersville had been given to the Redmond family as a puppy. Acting on the personal orders of John Morgan, the Republic's War Prevention Bureau had retaliated and successfully returned the favor in 2 cases, killing the ONR case officers who had put out the contract on Don. The third was an ONR assistant director named Dov Horowitz, the man who had sent the gunman into Don's home. Horowitz lived in Washington, D.C. He always traveled in armored vehicles, and he never spent the night at the same place twice. The WPB periodically assured Don that Mr. Horowitz was still very prominently featured on their hit parade, and that he had hopes of good news in the fullness of time. Don wasn't worried. The mills of the hunters sometimes ground slowly, but they were ground exceedingly fine. The motto over the entrance to the War Prevention Bureau's fortified and top-security compound in Lacey read in German, "Alles wird abgenecht." All accounts will be settled. The enemy ONR seemed to have gotten the message, and things had been quiet for some years now. Morgan made himself at a public point of honor never to seek personal vengeance for attacks against himself, but trying to murder a member of his family was very high on the not recommended list. Other than the one apparently extemporaneous incident, the Americans had never attempted to harm any of Don's family, possibly because they understood that the consequences of such an attack would ignite a blood feud with the numerous Morgans and Redmonds, the negative consequences of which would far outweigh any possible benefits to the United States. But that incident had put Don at the top of the list to receive the latest generation Guelph puppy, and Bakersville was now part of the family. "Any problems?" asked Redmond. Bakersville woofed twice for no. Don went inside the house. In the large and friendly kitchen, he met his wife Sarah, a tall and graceful woman with dark brown hair that was just beginning to go gray. She was wearing an ankle-length dress, this one of brown wool, embroidered with Celtic designs having to do with her role as a Wiccan priestess. She was fixing supper for the clan. Don could smell and hear a pork roast sizzling in the old-fashioned electric oven he had built for her. Sarah refused to consider a cooking robot or even a microwave, which, she said, interfered with the harmonious vibrations of the home. "Hi, Snoopy," he said, kissing her on the cheek. He had started calling her that to tease her when he was a 12-year-old paperboy and Sarah was an 11-year-old in jeans with braces on her teeth and two pigtails on either side of her head that Don pretended reminded him of the long floppy ears of a cartoon character. They had spent long hours together on the back porch of the house in Bellevue while her father and his men had planned and implemented countless guerrilla attacks and acts of sabotage inside. Don's elder daughter, Cynthia Ellen Redmond, was helping her mother in the kitchen. "Hi, Dad," she said. The eldest Redmond daughter very greatly resembled Sarah in her younger years, the same slim, strong build and handsome features, but without the young Sarah's passion and wildness. Cindy was still wearing her green labor service coveralls. She had spent the day supervising a crew of younger people who were doing their mandatory year of manual work after graduating from high school. Today they had been raking leaves and doing landscaping at Priest Point Park. Next week they might be collecting the city's garbage or repairing an elderly couple's home. A few weeks before, Cindy and her crew had been in Yakima picking apples, and in the spring they would be out in the woods doing forestry work, planting seedlings, and stocking fisheries. The labor service was the Republic's response to the age-old excuse of capitalism as to why massive third-world immigration was needed. "Who does the dirty work?" moaned the old capitalists of the United States. "White and even black Americans won't get their hands dirty or work up a sweat. We must have all these brown coolies, or who will do the heavy, sweaty, stooping stuff?" In the Republic, everybody's children did. That meant everybody. Absolute equality of national service was the bedrock on which the system rested. Labor service deferments for young people were even harder to get than military deferments for young men. Everybody's kids worked with their hands for a year. Even if they were blind and in a wheelchair, a job was found for them counting widgets by touch or something of the kind. A field foreman's stripes gleamed on the left sleeve of Cindy's overall, indicating that she had voluntarily extended her time in the NLS beyond the legal one-year requirement. She was now 20 years old, a quiet and competent young woman. By graduating from high school and passing her history and moral philosophy course, she had already earned her C citizenship certificate and the single vote that came with it. Like many girls, Cindy had opted to go for her second level of citizenship through national service rather than through college or through marriage right out of high school. On completion of their year of labor service, boys went right into the military for another 2 years, and they left the army with a two-vote B category citizenship. Don's youngest daughter Ava was doing her homework on the dining room table, a history and moral philosophy assignment on the life of Commander George Lincoln Rockwell. Ava was 15 and starting to kick at the traces a bit. She wanted to achieve her own citizenship through the coveted cultural asset status as an actress. If she passed the H and MP course, and also the talent evaluation by the Ministry of Culture, she would get a C1 certificate as opposed to her sister's present C2. Ava was entering high school on the arts and humanities track, and she was doing well. She really did seem to have the true dramatic fire, and she had already appeared in two adolescent bit part roles on local television, which made both her parents proud enough to explode. Opportunities for actors were more numerous than one might think in the Republic, given that one of the primary national missions was preserving Western art and drama in the purest form. There were not only the Ministries of Culture and Broadcasting and the Northwest Film Board, but a number of prestigious private theater and movie companies. The Lord Chamberlain's Men in Seattle and Portland's Globe Theater Group were deemed to be among the most eminent and skillful Shakespearean and Restoration repertory companies in existence, attracting talent from all over the rapidly diminishing English-speaking world. Ava intended to try and get her own labor service assignment as a stagehand and set builder for the NBA or one of the private companies. Nor were other canons of the European tradition neglected. Ava's drama class was producing Edmund Rostand's Cyrano de Bergerac in the original French for Thanksgiving Theater Day, with Ava playing the female lead as Roxanne. Only in the Northwest Republic could the classical works of Western drama now be performed in their original texts without later interpolations of multiculturalism and political correctness. In the spring, they were planning for a field trip to make a video movie of Wuthering Heights to be filmed in eastern Oregon as a viable substitute for the Yorkshire Moors. Ava was determined to snag the role of Kathy, although she had told her father that if the family adopted a Lebensborn child before then, she would stay home and help her mother with the infant. Public schooling in the Northwest was superior to anything in any American university, and many European ones. The culture and education ministries were convinced by the catastrophic American precedent of the last century that the devil made work for idle hands, and that it was in the interest of both society and of the child to keep him out of trouble by making sure that from kindergarten onward, until the boys went into the army and the girls went into college, or marriage, school was a full-time job. The party took an iron hard line against various degenerate entertainments and pastimes of the kind that had wasted whole generations of white youth before the Revolution. Instead of skateboards, Northwest kids got Shakespeare. They had computer games in abundance, but instead of mindless destruction of bizarre alien life forms, all such games required the exercise of young minds to outwit the programming through swift analysis, thought, and reaction. Instead of the holographic virtual reality games and pornography that rotted the minds of American children of all races, Northwest boys and girls got virtual time travel that let them see and hear and smell everything from the hiss of clothyard shafts at Agincourt to a day in the life of a pioneer family heading west in a Conestoga wagon circa 1850. High school graduates were required, among other attainments, to speak, read, and write fluently in four languages, English, Latin, and two others not their native tongue. The Latin requirement was not only for the increased knowledge it gave the child of modern languages descended from the tongue of ancient Rome, but also because of the declensions and syntax imposed an orderly mental discipline on the child's mind. Latin has no equivalent of, like, whatever, dude. Most Northwest high school students chose Spanish for one of their languages, for the very practical reason that it was the primary tongue of their national enemy, and it would prove of use. Ava had impressed the hell out of her parents by choosing French and Italian. When she had made her choices known, Don asked his daughter why. French, in honor of the one nation who dared to oppose the American Empire back in the old days, the girl had replied. Italian, because I always hear Aunt Tori and Big Bill speaking it, and it's beautiful. I want to talk with Tori in Italian. Cindy L. was prim and attractive, but she promised to grow into handsome and matronly woman. But Ava had the makings of a true beauty. The girl was blonde and willowy, her hair a shining and living sheaf of gold, and her walk was that of a princess, who would grow to become a queen. When Ava entered a room, every male eyeball from 8 to 80 clicked, and it worried Don. For Cindy, there had only been one, Mark Conway, one of nature's true gentlemen, and neither of them had ever given her parents a moment of worry. With Ava, chasing every teenage boy in Olympia away from the house had already become an almost full-time job for him and Sarah both. The kids were even willing to brave Bakersville for a moment or two in Evie's company. Middle son Matt, aged 19, was stationed in Twin Falls doing his army service and trying to live down the reputation of his famous namesake. He was going to major in political science and criminal justice when he got out of the army, and he had already told his father he wanted to follow him into Boss after the required minimum 3 years in the Civil Guard as a police officer. Somehow, it just seemed right that there should always be a cop named Matt Redman in the service of his people. Third son, John, was now aged 8 and worshipped his spaceman brother, Alan. John's room was full of photos, prints, and crayon drawings of Alan, the Martian landscape, and the spaceship Vanguard that took Alan to Mars. "Cindy L's getting married," John breathlessly informed to his father as he mounted the stairs to his bedroom. "Well, one would hope," agreed Don genially. "I'd like to get her off my hands sometime this century." "She's getting married to Mark Conway," yelped John excitedly. "Yeah, well, I'd admire if you let Cindy and your mother tell me all about it, youngin," said Don. Every now and then a little bit of the South still slipped into Don's speech, relics from his uncle and later association with John Morgan. Don hung up his coat and his gun in the bedroom closet and took off his tie, and then put on the smoking jacket the girls had given him on his last birthday. On his way back downstairs, Don poked his head into the sitting room of his aunt, the Contessa Stopaglia. "Hey, Aunt Tori, how was your day?" "Fine," said the old lady. She was a tall and elegant woman in her 70s, always flawlessly dressed. Tonight she sat by the log fire in her hearth wearing a tweed suit. On her lapel was a green, white, and blue ribbon of the War of Independence identical to Don's. The kids did watercolors and made all kinds of lovely technicolor messes on their papers and on themselves, and we all enjoyed ourselves immensely. Spry, despite her age, Tori was a volunteer kindergarten teacher in Tumwater, where she managed a class of 20 little hellions with just the right combination of love, skill, and firmness. Her class called her Granny, but worshipped her as a god. "You coming to the reunion tonight?" asked Don. "Oh, I don't know," said Tori. "These shindigs are pretty depressing, really. They're all much the same, just like any gathering of old folks. A bunch of aging men and a few old biddies like me, getting quietly or not so quietly spiffled and learning who's passed on, who's having prostate surgery, and showing off the latest pictures of the grandchildren, along with belting out a few of those magnificent bloody songs we stole from the Irish. Then the memories start to crowd in, first the good ones, and then a lot of them not so good. And by the end of the evening, we're all maudlin drunk, remembering the ones who ought to be there but who never made it. I don't know if I'm up to it tonight, Don. In any event, I was always a rather reluctant revolutionary." Don looked over to a large framed portrait on Tori's mantelpiece, over the crackling wood fire. It showed a young woman with long, honey-colored hair standing beside a darkly handsome man like a young Frank Sinatra, with a long scar on his cheek. In the background was a wide lawn fronting a tall, white marble villa in Tuscany. The youthful Tori Redman held a wedding banquet, bouquet, and her face burned like a proud and radiant brand over the distance of more than half a century. "Still miss him?" asked Don. "Every day," she replied softly. "I think his love made me a Sicilian myself, you know. I still speak the dialect like a native, or so Bill assures me. He ought to know. He grew up in Castellamare del Golfo. When the monsters took Tony from me, I decided I would devote the rest of my life to making them pay. I always wondered if they understood that. The terrible rage of the widow whose beloved man has been taken away forever. The power of the vendetta. Their own stupidity in unleashing it upon themselves." "Tori, more than any of us, you earned that ribbon," said Don quietly. "I really think you should come with us tonight. I miss Mom and Matt as well, but you and Bill and all those great kids of yours make up for it," continued Tori, as if she had not heard him. "I remember the old world I grew up in, Don, and I will always thank you and those people at that get-together tonight for making this new one for me and the children. But somehow, tonight, I don't feel like going back there, not even for an evening. We sing about it like we were all Irish, but the fact is that it was a very bad time, a time of horrid wretchedness and evil. At my age, I think I've earned the right to be a bit selective about which parts of the past my mind wanders back to. Can you make my excuses for me? Tell them my lumbago's acting up or something. Sure, Tori, said Don with a laugh. He strolled back downstairs into the kitchen and poured himself a bourbon and soda from the bottle of Old Log Cabin, product of the state distillery in Hayden Lake. Cindy L. had gone upstairs to change out of her coveralls. Your dad called me over to Longview House today, he told her. Another special job. What did he want? Asked Sarah. Wanted to talk about the Andrews case first, like I figured he might. Then he surprised me. He told me a ghost story, replied Matt. Eh? He usually saves those for the annual Halloween bonfire, said Sarah. This time it's a real one. A ghost from revolutionary times is about to rise from the dead, although she may return there very quickly. What are you talking about? Asked Sarah. Most men in Boss made it a point never to bring their work home with them. But since the first day they had met, there had never been a single secret between Don and Sarah except for one, by a kind of unspoken consent, which was her mother's death during the revolution. Even that wasn't really a secret. It was simply something that they never spoke of. In any case, Sarah was an Alpha One citizen and a party member with full security clearance. Don sat down at the kitchen table and ran down his morning's conversation with the president. Oh, that poor woman, exclaimed Sarah when she had finished, shaking her head in horror. Just think of it, Don. Even if she is a traitor, imagine what it must have been like to carry all that guilt all these years, never able to live among your own people, but forced to exist in that human cesspool down there. And if she's innocent... If she's innocent, then someone has been thumbing their nose at justice for almost a lifetime, replied Don, grimly. Some of those survivors are in key positions in the Republic now. If that's the case, then I wonder what the hell they've been up to since then. Don, said Sarah in a worried voice, what about Bill Vitale? I know, Snoops. Bill was one of the 8 people who survived the Olympic Flying Column. And before you ask, I don't believe for one instant that Bill Vitale has ever committed anything even remotely resembling a dishonorable act. Nor do I, said Sarah. But do you see now why we have to find out, one way or the other? If Trudy Griner really is innocent of treason, or if she is guilty and for whatever reason she's decided to go out with one last attempt to throw sand in our faces, if she can create any kind of doubt at all, then Bill and the others will live the rest of their lives under a shadow. Are you going to say anything about this to Aunt Tori? Demanded Sarah. Holy Moses, no. If she thought I was investigating Big Bill Vitale, she'd stick a stiletto in my ear, laughed Don. How are you going to go after it, then? Asked Sarah. I've already started. I spent this afternoon digging around in the records at work. The ones we captured from the feds when they pulled out. They're not complete, though. A lot of the relevant material was destroyed before Zog skedaddled, especially stuff related to their informants. It took us years to dig some of them out of their holes. I'll start with the Fatpo defector, McBride, and then I'll have to talk to the 8 survivors of the Olympic Flying Column, of course. But I'm blessed if I can see what I could possibly turn up after all these years. Actual information is so sparse that even if they're all straight with me, it's likely that they all will be able to come up with will be ancient memories and half-memories. Criminy, Snoops, we're talking about a trail that went cold when I was 10 years old. We may have to wait for Trudy Griner to rock up and finally tell us her side of the story. And then we hope to God she doesn't have some piece of evidence or proof that shatters one of the greatest legends of the War of Independence. Even though we've raised a whole new generation and we're working on our second, the Republic is still under siege. We're the only nation on Earth whose very right to exist is not accepted by most of the world. We don't need and can't stand a scandal like this. Who knows where it could lead? He sighed. Never mind. Enough about work for the evening. Now what's this about Cindy getting married to Mark Conway? I mean, it's not unexpected. It's always been on the cards since they were in elementary school, but have we finally gotten a formal proposal? She smiled. Yep. "We received a registered letter from Pastor Marlon Carlyle today," said Sarah, handing him the envelope. "I'm flattered the Conways elected to use the most prominent Christian identity minister in the country as the matchmaker." Don read the letter out loud. "On behalf of the Conway family and their son, Mark Isaiah, blah blah, a true and honorable affection having grown between Mark and your daughter Cynthia Ellen, blah blah blah. Sure looks like a proposal to me," said Don, glancing over the text. "And they're not asking for a dowry. Always a sign of a love match." "Okay, Snoops. Now that it's finally coming down to brass tacks, how do you feel about the prospect of Mark as a member of the family?" "I think he's a fine young man and a very good catch for our daughter. I always have." "I agree, 100%. Does Cindy L. think he's a good catch?" "Oh, yes. You said it yourself. She's been chasing him for years." "But," prodded Don, sensing a small hesitation. Sarah frowned slightly and chose her words carefully. "Cindy L. wants the marriage, but the religion aspect worries me a bit. Cindy L. has never been all that spiritual in the old ways. Not like Eva, who does all her alignments every day. Cindy's the stolid and down-to-earth one among our kids. She always was. She lives very much in this world. We've talked about it, and she assures me she won't have any problem attending church with Mark or allowing their children to be raised as Christians." "Yeah, well, at least the Conways are CI and not holy rolling Pentecostals who want to burn you at the stake for that voodoo you do so well. I know that Zog persecutes them, but I swear that sometimes I think that's one group of immigrants the Republic could do without. It's really ironic. In the United States, the Pentecostals are accused of being racist and fascists because they preach against interracial marriage and homosexuality to their congregations, but when they come here, they cause nothing but trouble. They get in everybody's face demanding Bravo citizenship without having served in the military. At least once a year, I have to bust some group of tub-thumpers for sneaking into race and politics disguised as religion, especially since they can't seem to shake this stupid, obscene idea about Jews being God's chosen people. They're as hare-brained as Todd Andrews and his so-called heroic vitalist center. How odd of God to choose the Jews," quipped Sarah. "Not news, not odd. The Jews chose God," replied Don with a smile. "We've news for the Jews. They're going to lose," giggled Sarah, completing the third line. "To think that one used to carry 10 years in federal prison." "Yeah, I know. Sometimes I think we overthrew the United States government simply for the right to tell jokes. But the Conways aren't bigots like the Pentecostals. Your father came to accept your own adoption of the craft," pointed out Don. "Nor do I mind having Christians in the family, as long as they're sane and decent people. Why shouldn't it work in reverse?" "Dad is an old hoot and holler Baptist, not Christian identity," said Sarah. "Insofar as he has any religion at all, which isn't very far. The Aryan race is his real religion, always has been. He thinks my craft is just a silly little girl phase that I never grew out of. It doesn't offend him, because he doesn't take it seriously. Yes, I know, the Conways are good folks, and they think the world of Cindy, but I'm concerned about how the rest of the CI community here will treat her when they learn she was brought up in the old ways. It seems to be getting worse every year, this pointless, stupid bickering over religion. Why can't we just lay it aside? Like we don't have enough problems with all those American maniacs constantly scheming to reconquer and enslave us all again." "It seems to be the peculiar curse of our race," sighed Don. "I know it was during the early days of the movement," recalled Sarah. "Commander Rockwell and the old man tore their hair out trying to get what few people we had to see sense on the issue and not fight over it." "It was bad," agreed Don. "It's hard to believe that even at the height of Zog's power, there were racially aware white people who hated other white people so badly that they would rather Zog continue to rule than the people they hated have any part in the solution. That period of history was never entirely sane. And in some respects, we're just as nutty. Even before Zog, religion was our curse. We spent many centuries merrily butchering one another by the millions over the great jumping Jesus, yea or nay how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. No matter how imminent the existential threat from the Untermenschen, there is always a white man somewhere that we hate worse. It's like we need a white opponent to fight against, as if it fills some deep psychological need. It's almost as if a non-white enemy just doesn't fit the bill in some weird corner of our soul. I always thought that Commander Rockwell had the best way of dealing with it, which is just not deal with it. The Constitution of the Republic gives every man and woman the right to freedom of religion, freedom to practice their faith and to raise their children in that faith, with the critical proviso that they do not attempt to disguise political activity or ideology wrapped in a religious cloak. That is a lesson we learned the hard way back in the 20th century, when the established Christian churches then were almost totally corrupted with Zionism and sexual perversion. In the States, they still are. We rightly guard ourselves against that particular Trojan horse. But beyond that, we should all worship God or the gods in our own way, and just shut the hell up about it. Sorry, I know I'm rambling, but the whole situation just plain ticks me off. Listening to one's husband ramble comes with a wife's job description, she said, with a quick kiss. Look, Tim and Stephanie Conway are both B-category citizens. They've got prosperous contracting business building immigrant housing for new settlers, good quality homes and apartments. We've known them for years, and I've never seen a sign of bigotry against any other white person or group out of them. They know you're a Wiccan, and I'm a National Socialist, and if it's ever bothered them, I've never detected it. And I'm a detective, remember? Mark's a fine and steady boy. He's coming out of the army in January and going to work for his dad part-time, and the rest of that time, he's going to work on a civil engineering degree from Oregon State. That would mean that he and Cindy would have to move down to Portland, but hey, it happens. They grow up, Snoops. It's the right point in both of their lives for him and Cindy to both start a family, and I've got no problem with it if Cindy doesn't. Don grinned at his wife. You just don't want to give Cindy the little talk, he said with a chuckle. I already did last year, she reminded him. Just in case she and Mark... Well, never mind. We both know that wouldn't have happened. Mark is almost like a medieval knight with his lady when he's with Cindy. But still, I figured it was better to be safe than sorry. Thank the gods that we now live in a society where it was mine to do. I remember my sex education classes starting in second grade, before the revolution. Some of them were so filthy I still can't believe anyone could teach such things to children. I was homeschooled by my aunt and uncle for that very reason. This is now. What did you think of it then? Asked Don, curiously. I was 7 years old, and you have to remember most of what we were taught wasn't normal sex. I thought it was all very silly and gross, and it convinced me that grown-ups were mostly insane. Why on earth would they want to do nasty stuff like that otherwise? One day I went home and told Dad about what we were doing in class. The day after that, Dad came to school and beat the faggot sex ed teacher to a bloody pulp. That was his first arrest for hate crime. He broke out of King County Jail, and from then on it was, well, you know what it was like. But I never went back to that school. Cindy came back into the kitchen, wearing a skirt and sweater, and without asking, piled steaming potatoes au gratin into a large bowl for the dinner table. Hi, Princess, said Don to his daughter. Look, honey, got a moment? Can you step into the study? I'd like to talk to you. I reckon you know what about. Sure, Dad, said the girl. Been upstairs talking with Aunt Tori? Yes. She wants me to tell the reunion tonight that her lumbago's acting up, which is horse hockey. She'll outlive us all. They went into Don's den and sat down on the sofa together. No bull now, Cindy. Mark Conway has formally asked our family for permission to marry you. I want to know how you feel about it. Actually, I was the one who asked him to marry me, said Cindy with a smile. Once when we were 8 years old. And then again, seriously, a year ago, before he went into the army. I haven't changed my mind. That's all I need to hear, Princess. I'll send my formal acceptance to Pastor Carlisle tomorrow. I'll also call Mark at his unit up on the Yukon border, and I'll tell him the good news myself. He leaned over and kissed her. May the both of you know nothing but joy and fulfillment all your lives. Now, in view of your coming change of situation, I expect you want to be honest with me about everything. How can I help? Don expected a calm and serious assessment of the young couple's financial and material needs prior to their each receiving their life grants from the state. Those needs he was fully prepared to fulfill with all the resources at his command, including his father-in-law's as well, for he knew he could speak to John Corbett on this. After all, this was Cindy, the practical and unsentimental one. It was her way. Cindy L. rarely surprised him, but this time she managed it. Dad, what was the old country like? Huh? Asked Don in surprise. Cindy, why on earth would you ask me that now? I was just thinking about Mark and me today, she told him. I was wondering what our children will be like, what kind of world they will grow up in, wondering if my sons will have to fight another war to keep our country alive. And then I started wondering what it would have been like if you had stayed behind, what kind of life would they have had, or even if they would be at all, or I would have been born at all. That, and you and Mom going to the reunion tonight, reminded me how much we owe you. But I just got curious. All around me every day I meet and speak with new people, new settlers, and they all know where they came from. I guess like all us woodchucks who were born here, I sometimes feel there's something missing. I hear people speaking in German and Russian and Afrikaans, or in English with accents from England and Ireland and New Zealand and Massachusetts. It's like they have something I don't, in a way. So I wonder, what was our own land like, the land we lived in before we came home? Honey, I was only 6 years old when we left North Carolina. I have lived all my life since then here in the homeland. Never wanted to be anywhere else. But surely you must remember something, pressed Cindy. I hear a little of it in your voice sometimes, a passing reference to this or that. That's mostly from growing up around Uncle Matt, and from your grandfather, pointed out Don. I picked up some of their speech patterns second hand. I'm not really a Carolinian. I know. I wish I had known Uncle Matt. So do I, Princess. Matt and Heather both. You missed something there. It's almost like North Carolina is a ghost that follows us everywhere. Someone once called us a haunted people. Haunted by our past. Haunted by the many lands we came from. I want to know our family ghosts, Dad. So I can tell my own children about them someday. Our own land, the land long ago, what was it like? Can you tell me anything? Well, yeah, I remember a little. I dream about it sometimes, said Redmond slowly. Just hazy images, mostly. The kind a person of my age retains from their early childhood. Not much, and what there is doesn't hang together very coherently. There are some bad memories, like gangs of ugly black children with big bubble lips and nappy frizz heads chasing me and beating me with sticks, throwing rocks at me if I came out of my yard, and that kind of thing. But there are good memories as well. Sometimes I dream about the summer, the muggy, burning heat of a kind that we never get here, or at least we never get here on the South Sound. I dream about air conditioners rumbling in the windows, dripping water from the condensation. I remember green and leafy trees. Kind of the same as we have here, but different as well. The trees were smaller than here, but with bigger leaves, and the Carolina pines are different from our firs and cedars. I know that because I've seen photos, but I remember it too. At least, I think I do. Taller, straighter, and in my mind, I see pine cones and brown pine needles like a carpet on the ground everywhere. Soft dirt, softer than here, darker, and sometimes sand. I remember going to a place once that my parents called Cliffs of the Noose, which is a river in Carolina. I remember there were big tall pine trees growing up there out of hard white sand. I remember looking down on the water, and it was kind of muddy, greenish-brown, not like the blue of the Sound here. I remember going to places with old cannons, Fort Fisher and Bentonville. They were Civil War battlefields where Southern soldiers fought against the United States, very long ago, in the first time when our people had revolted against the Americans. Later, Zog had all those sites plowed under, and all the relics were destroyed, and it became against the law to even speak of that time or to honor any of our ancestors who fought for the Confederacy. Display of any Confederate flag or insignia still carries 10 years federal prison time now, if I recall correctly. But mostly, I remember autumn in Carolina. The trees blazing with gold and red and brown, the air clear and chill. I remember a Halloween or two, jack-o'-lanterns on porches and beautiful golden leaves on the ground. You may want to know what I most recall about the old country, honey. I remember Halloween. My brother and my sister and I used to go trick-or-treating. Uncle Matt took us as well, with his gun worn outside in his hip. He was a North Carolina state cop then. He was one of the few white men who was still allowed to carry a weapon after the Schumer Act. He went with us so none of the black kids messed with us or stole our candy. Yeah, I'd have to say it was Halloween I remember best. There was just something different in the air than here. Maybe because we were closer to the real old country. The Europe that our ancestors came from in those tiny wooden ships. My Christmases? Those are all here, Cindy L., and thanks to Matt and Heather, they were good ones. I guess that's the best way I can explain it. Halloween means the old country to me, but Christmas means the homeland. I hope that makes some kind of sense to you. And your father and your mother? My grandparents? Asked Cindy. I actually can't remember that much about them, which I suppose is something I ought to feel badly about. But in my mind, they were always kind of overshadowed by images of Matt and Heather. I wasn't with them when they were killed, thank God, said Don. It happened in the state capital, Raleigh, what they called a carjacking in those days. A Mexican gang specialized in stealing late model cars and shipping them to South America. Rather than take the time to break in and maybe damage the merchandise, they simply waited for a nice car, driven by white people, to pull up to a stoplight or a park, and then dragged them out, killed them, and drove off with the car. It happened all the time in those days. I remember my Uncle Matt and Aunt Heather coming to our house and asking us, my brother and sister and me, if we'd like to go on a long trip. I didn't know it, but they were actually taking us away for good, one step ahead of Child Protective Services. This was before It Takes a Village, but the government was already using the law to kidnap white children and give them to liberals and, well, to other kinds of people. The courts had declared Matt and Heather to be unfit guardians because of Matt's so-called history of anti-government activities, which involved his job as a state police officer. He had this funny idea that the law applied to federals as well, and back in the old days he reigned on a number of Washington's parades, so I understand. Plus, there was that business with Bill Vitale. They never forgave him for that, especially Hillary. The old man wrote a book about it, which you may have read. Anyway, we kids were put on a train to Seattle with Aunt Heather. We couldn't fly because we had to travel under false names. I do remember that long, long trip. I remember changing trains in this big, huge station in Chicago, where I ate a messy hot dog while sitting on a hard bench and slopped chili all over my shirt and pants, while about 100 radios all around seemed to be shrieking out Mexican salsa music. I remember seeing the Rockies coming up ahead in the train's observation car, capped with snow, and my first sight of blue lakes in Montana. Heather took us to her uncle, Oscar Lindstrom, and he hid us in the cabin out near Yelm for a year or so until Matt and Heather were able to make it home themselves. Will we ever be able to go back? Asked Cindy, softly. Why? Do you want to go back? Asked Don in surprise. I mean, it's not a bad thing if you do. A lot of people here believe they will go back someday, to the lands of their birth. Everywhere from Germany to Milwaukee to South Africa. I think all of us want to go back, at least a little. Not for good, I don't think. I was born here. My home is the Northwest, and I guess it will always will be. But it just makes me mad that the Americans won't give us entry visas, won't even let us go back to visit, like we're contaminated or something. To them, we are contaminated, said her father. We are contaminated with two things they fear more than anything. Courage and racial pride. They spent 70 years stamping out courage and pride of our people, and yet, despite it, here we are in the Northwest, springing back up again like weeds. I'd just like to see Carolina someday, she said, wistfully. Someday, yes, I think we'll be able to go back, said Don. Not in my lifetime, but maybe in yours. I'd say pretty certainly that your children will be able to go back someday if they want. Honey, you know that the homeland was never intended to be a prison for us. It's a lifeboat, a place of refuge. One day the men and women of our race will grow strong and brave again, and more importantly, we will grow many. There will be enough of us so that we can kick down the walls they've built around us and take it all back. America, Canada, that our forefathers made. Speaking of those children you mentioned, Cindy, before God, are you sure you want Mark Conway to be their father? Honey, I don't want to pressure you or try to force you. When all is said and done, it's your decision. Yes, Dad. I've known Mark was the one since I was a child. Dad, and Mark knew the same about me. Just like you knew Mom was the one, and she told me she knew you. I just had it a lot easier than you did. You two had to meet and recognize one another in a bad time of fear and violence and sickness. I didn't have to go through that. You and Mom and Papa John and Aunt Tori made a world where it was possible for Mark and me to come together without fear, guilt, or confusion, where young white people aren't driven half insane by what's happening around them. I know enough history to understand that. And don't ever forget it, Cindy L., because if you do, you and your children will be forced to repeat it. Now let's get into supper before the smell of that crackling pork drives me nuts. After dinner, while his wife was dressing for the reunion, Don went into the library and pulled out his comm phone. He called his old friend Charlie Randall. When Randall's mug appeared on the screen, it turned out to be a kindly, grandfatherly face, weather-beaten, with a shock of gray hair. It was definitely not the face one would expect of one of the Republic's foremost intelligence operatives and assassins, with a record of happy homicide going back to the War of Independence. "Good day, mate," said Randall, his speech the purest Brisbane. "Long time no jabber. Been meaning to give you a bell and offer my congrats on catching the bloody Bill Vitale clone and busting those nutters who wanted to waste Pastor Briggs." "Hey, Cobber," said Don. "Thanks, but it's all in a day's work. It could be worse. I could be mowing lawns for the labor service. Look, Charlie, something's come up, and I need to have a word with you regarding a new case I'm working on. It's nothing of immediate urgency or any imminent threat to state security, just some background on the old days. You gonna be at the association shindig tonight?" "Be there with the bells on," agreed Randall. "Wouldn't want to miss a chance to dance with that lovely wife of y'all's. Long as I get a chance to dance with Linda, let's try to make some time for a jawjack then." A little past 8 o'clock, Don and Sarah arrived at the downtown Olympia Hilton for the annual social of the old NVA Association. The Redmonds always made it a point to show up for the annual reunions. They were a renowned couple, since between them both they were the youngest veterans who were entitled to wear the War of Independence ribbon. As they walked in, almost as if by arrangement, the loudspeakers struck up Sir William Walton's Crown Imperial March. The walls were festooned with tricolor flags and long green, white, and blue ribbons. Over the great banquet room, crowded with people and labor service waiters, heavy with the smell of good food and tobacco smoke, hung a heavy silk banner of blue lettered in white. It was the one that the Western Washington chapter of the old NVA Association hung out at every one of their social and political functions. On the banner was emblazoned the immortal passage from Shakespeare's Henry V. "This day is called the Feast of Crispin. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand a tiptoe when this day is named and rouse him at the name of Crispin. He that shall live this day and see old age will yearly on this day feast his neighbors and say, tomorrow is Saint Crispin. Then will he strip and sleeve and show his scars, and say, these wounds I had on Crispin's day. Old men forget, Yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in his mouth as household words, Harry the King, Bedford the Executor, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by, from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered, we few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, and this day shall gentle his condition, and gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whiles any speaks that fought with us on St. Crispin's Day. There was a scattering of applause as the Redmans entered the room and were recognized. "Hey, Don," came the chorus of greetings from a dozen people at the bar. "Hey, Sarah. Looking good, Sarah. How's the Carolina kid?" "Getting old, boys," replied Don merrily. "Almost as old as some of you relics. This time next year we'll all have creaking joints. Hey, you young whippersnapper, I might remind you that this particular old relic done outshot your ass by 30 points on the police range last August," yelled the retired head of the Republic Steel Production Corporation, who was also the head of NAR's state rifle team. Without asking, he thrust a huge stone tankard of Bavarian pattern into Don's hand, brimming with frothing ale from the Red Hook Brewery. Lemuel Harris had been born in Alabama. He had come to the Northwest as a fugitive from American justice for the crime of defending his life on a dark night in Mobile against a crazed drug addict. His sentence had been 7 years state time for the killing itself, and 30 years federal without parole for the racist crime of being a man with white skin who raised his hand against a man with black skin. Harris broke out of a prison bus and walked 3,000 miles, mostly at night, until he reached the homeland, eating out of dumpsters and killing 4 police officers along the way who tried to apprehend him. Some years before, the business correspondent of the Times of London had interviewed him and asked him about the trek. Harris replied, "I killed when I had to, but I never stole a single dime or so much as a mouthful of food from anyone along the way." "Might another of us superannuated old relics impose on your lovely lady for the first dance after dinner?" asked another elderly gentleman, with a courtly bow towards Sarah. The left sleeve of his flawless black evening dress suit was empty, pinned back against his side. By old custom for these functions, he had left his perfectly functioning prosthetic limb at home this evening, for tonight the wounds of the past were acknowledged and displayed for the world to see. Zack McAllister's arm had been blown off during the Kennewick Flying Column's attack on the fortified Fatpo barracks in Yakima, when he had picked up a grenade and tried to throw it back at the Federals. It exploded in his hand. A 19-year-old student paramedic had amputated and cauterized the bleeding stump, without anesthetic, in the back of a van, while the Fatpo patrols swarmed outside. A single outcry would have given away their position. The wounded man never uttered a sound. The paramedic was now the mayor of Coos Bay, Oregon, and was no doubt attending his own reunion this evening. "You're going to have to fight Charlie Randall for her, Zack. You realize, of course, that this is what you get for being the youngest woman in the room," chuckled Don to Sarah, "as well as the most beautiful." He leaned over and kissed his wife quickly and affectionately. Someone overheard him. "Hey now, Sarah's a looker, I'll grant you that, but she's got some competition. Reckon I can still kick up my heels with some of these young studs," cackled Cassie Kowalski, a lean and weather-beaten old crone in a chic blue velvet brocade evening gown. Her once red hair was now dyed blue. A cigarette dangled from her lips, and her liver-spotted knuckles, as they curled around the tumbler of straight whiskey, were swollen with arthritis. It was hard to believe that in the time of struggle she had been a statuesque hooker so stunning that her code name had been Lorelei, and that her beauty had lured over a dozen federal bureaucrats, politicians, and senior media executives to their deaths. She once took out a United States senator herself with an ice pick through his left ear. Over 300 elderly men thronged the room, along with a few matronly and gray-haired women, and a small army of younger relatives. Across the banquet hall, Don saw a dignified old couple in evening dress, Ed and Brittany McCandless, two survivors of the Olympic flying column that he would have to interview. He raised his stein to them in greeting. Before he could go over and speak to them, he was intercepted. "Hi, Don, Sarah. Have you met my eldest son, Jeff?" said an old woman whom Don vaguely knew, but whose name for the moment escaped him. She glowed with the pride of a long lifetime as she introduced a bashful young giant in full SS dress black, the swastika armband gleaming crimson, white, and black on his left bicep. He just graduated from Standpoint in June, and he's already gotten his first lieutenant's bar, as the old woman crowed. "Jeff, this is Colonel Donald Redmond from Boss." "Redmond, got it? As in Matt Redmond?" "It's an honor to meet you, sir," shouted the young soldier, bracing to stiff attention, in an obvious agony of social discomfort, meeting the most legendary name in the Republic after the old man himself. "Hey, at ease, troop," laughed Redmond, slapping him on the shoulder. "These gigs are completely informal and eclectic, I promise you. Now go get drunk like we all came for. That's an order, soldier." "Yes, sir, I will get drunk, sir. Thank you, sir," shouted the young man. "And make sure your grandmother gets drunk as well," Redmond admonished him. "I want her completely pistis nudis before the night is over." "Yes, sir." Here was a retired dentist who had printed over $50 million in counterfeit U.S. currency and $4 million in postage stamps on an underground printing press in his basement. There was a senior official of the Northwest Reserve Bank who had once huddled in the bottom of a porta-potty for 8 hours and then given a United States Marine Corps general a .44 caliber enema. He was talking to an assistant minister of finance and also to Cindy's ultimate boss, the head of the Republic's Labor Service. The assistant minister of finance had begun his fiscal career when he led an NVA team that kidnapped the daughter of Seattle's chief rabbi and successfully collected a $2 million ransom, afterwards returning her unharmed and unviolated, as he had given his word would be done if the ransom was paid. He had shot one of his own men in the kneecap who attempted to kill the Jewish girl anyway after the ransom was paid. The volunteer whom the assistant minister had shot had become an SS officer who later died a hero at Chilliwack while earning his third Iron Cross. They had never been reconciled, and that was the assistant minister's deepest regret in life, a failure that haunted him through sleepless nights. Cindy's boss, the Minister of Labor, had been brought into an FBI interrogation center with 3 bullets in his body, and with his wounds yet bleeding, he had still managed to strangle his first interrogator with his bare hands. Over there in another corner was a Luftwaffe general who presently commanded a space shuttle. In the Battle of Portland, he had been a pilot who made over 50 low-level bombing runs, dropping homemade explosives onto federal positions from whatever small aircraft he could get to fly, in several cases microlights of canvas and aluminum tubing, and in another, an ancient Boeing 737 he and his crew had converted to a bomber. Each time he had returned to his airstrip, his plane shredded with bullets. He had once landed a stolen helicopter in the main yard at the Florence Federal Prison in Colorado to extract 5 NVA prisoners. At the far end of the hall sat an elderly automobile mechanic, eating from a plate of fried chicken and potato salad, and guzzling from a tall tumbler. Kenneth McGrath had long ago blocked out the memory of the horror, the years in prison, the beatings and electric shock to his genitals. All he knew was that this was an occasion once a year when he got free food and top-notch hooch. Ken had never been a party member, and he was never into all that political shit. He never understood why these people had given him an Iron Cross for that one particular incident. Old Kenny wore it on these nights because he figured it was kind of expected of him, in exchange for the food and the booze, but privately, he thought it was a bit silly. He wasn't even German. Some white people were in trouble with some niggers, and he had helped them. Seemed like the thing to do at the time. So what? The whole episode was exaggerated. Everybody knew that niggers were never anywhere near as tough as they were cracked up to be, and they'd run like scalded dogs from any white man who stood up to them. Even niggers with badges. Whoop-dee-doo. And the shooting bit was highly exaggerated as well. His dad had made better shots hunting buck and moose lots of times. Wasn't like he'd done anything special. Hey, if these people wanted to give him free food and liquor every year because of some stupid shit that happened when he was 23, who was he to argue? Politics weren't important to Ken McGrath. Alcohol-burning V8 engines and methane turbine generators were important. Start up a good engine and you saw God's plan for the universe. At one table sat a fifth-generation Washington farmer, who grew, every year, acres of wheat and sorghum over the graves of six FBI agents he and his team had killed in a night ambush and buried on his ancestral land. At another sat a man who made cuckoo clocks in his garage, their cunning and accurate mechanisms based on the bomb-timing devices he had made in his youth. There was a woman with 16 grandchildren knocking back Singapore slings, who had been a young police dispatcher in Seattle, and kept the NVA apprised of every move the cops made. Beside her was her husband, whose lumpy fingers were missing their fingernails. The nails had been torn out and the cuticles soldered in an FBI torture chamber when he refused to inform on his wife. Down the bar was little old Eddie Cartwright, a non-entity who now held the official position of town drunk in Shelton, Washington. Oddly enough, Eddie was almost the only one drinking ginger ale. On this, one night of all nights, he stayed sober and served as a designated driver for a busload of his former comrades in arms. It was a tradition within his unit, one he honored as an almost religious obligation. He had also stayed sober, admittedly with some effort, on the long-ago night when he drove a rental truck full of explosives up to the front gate of the federal detention facility in Auburn and detonated it. Eddie made it away, although just barely. Over 200 NVA prisoners had also made it out of the concentration camp, and the sudden return infusion of so many hardened guerrillas had given the embattled NVA a new lease on life. The evening's big attraction was a display along one of the walls of the banquet room, a series of big, blown-up U.S. government posters from the Revolution, of the kind that had once adorned every wall and boarding house in the Northwest states. Wanted by the Department of Homeland Security for acts of domestic terrorism, shrieked the posters in all caps, rewards up to $1 million for the apprehension of these individuals. Below the heavy black type on each placard were rows of 16 or 20 photographs of NVA men and women, mostly old mugshots, but a few fuzzy FBI surveillance photos as well. Little groups of guests were gathered before the posters, chuckling and pointing out old friends and comrades to their companions, in some cases pointing out their own mugshots. "You looked like Frankenstein with that shaven head," one elderly woman chided her husband merrily. "I was a monster, all right," returned the man quietly. "You wouldn't have wanted to know me in those days, Liz. Trust me, you wouldn't have." "There you go, that's Jerry Wallace," said another old man, pointing to a picture. "He always used to call himself the original Jerry Reb. Died last year, brain tumor. That's Willis McCoy. He's retired and living down in Astoria now. He said he'd try to make it tonight if he could get his daughter to drive him up here. I hope they come. Willis is a boring old fart, but that daughter of his is still mighty easy on the eyeballs for a gal of 50. That's Lee Donner. He was killed in the street fighting when we moved into Tacoma, during the assault on the federal building. I was there. That's Brigadier Jimmy Wilson," said another codger, lean and unshaven, the first drunk of the evening, his suit hanging on him like a scarecrow's rags. "Hot damn, I remember Jimmy. I was in his brigade for a while before me and Charlie Randall shot that TV fag from Channel 5. Jimmy sent us on that one personal. The fag had been talking some real shit on the air, but no more after me and Charlie looked him up. Charlie had a 45 peacemaker, and that bugger boy's fucking head busted open like a watermelon. Candy-ass fudge-packer son of a bitch. Charlie stuck it right in his mouth and said, "Suck on this, faggot," and then pop goes the weasel. Charlie and me had to go on the run, and the party sent me over to number 2 Boise on an E&E. That's escape and evasion. Yeah, like none of us remember what E&E was, Kev, muttered another surly old man who was listening, his accent still of the Mississippi Delta after all these years. Jimmy won the first Iron Cross the Republic ever issued, old Kev rambled on, oblivious. Brought down 2 Apaches outside Wintachi with nothing but a bolt-action rifle. It was a posthumous award. Fatty murdered him in prison the very day before we took it over. He used to fart a lot, kept eating them damned refried burritos. I used to ask him, "Jimmy, what kind of white man eats Mexican food?" He just used to say, "Mexican shit, I just like burritos. So does that make me some goddamn kind of race traitor?" They killed him in prison the very day before we came in, fatty motherfucker bastards. I found Jimmy in his cell in the Pullman camp, where they'd left him after they ran away. They shot him about 20 times. Shot him in the balls, a couple in the gut so they could watch him die slow. Fuck Longview. Longview said they wasn't supposed to murder our people no more, but they did it anyway. Goddamn fucking American, motherfucking American bastards. We should have kept on fighting. Kept on until we conquered Washington, D.C. and New York and killed them all. We should have took all our country back. Took all America back. All of it was ours. Our people made America. We should have took it all back, the land we had the chance. The old man began to weep. A young man with him, possibly a grandson, led him away. Like all nations, the Republic had developed its own ruling elite. For such is the nature of human society. But on this one night, all were comrades once again. For every man, and more than a few of the elderly and middle-aged women, wore the green, white, and blue ribbon on their lapel. That experience gentled their conditions indeed. All of them had been there on St. Crispin's Day. On many St. Crispin's Days during the War of Independence, when the impossible had suddenly not only become possible, but inevitable. The time when white men and women rose up in arms against the beast, the federal government of the United States, fought it, and defeated it. These were the aging, faded ghosts of that incredible time. The ones who had done what no one had ever believed could be done. The time to which Don Redmond was now compelled by duty to return. Don stopped before one of the wanted posters. "Look, there's John Corbett," he said, pointing out the old police mugshot of Sarah's father to her. Possibly even the one taken after he had been arrested for pulverizing her second-grade sex ed teacher. In the photo, Morgan's mighty beard was as black as the Harlan County coal instead of its present patriarchal white. The powerful, burning blue eyes sizzled out of the photo, searing the soul of the viewer. Then, as now, one could imagine him as a biblical prophet on a hilltop, calling down divine retribution on a sinful nation, which, in a sense, he had indeed done. That was back in his million-dollar man days. Morgan had been the second NVA commander to reach the coveted million-dollar reward status. Commandant Tom Murdoch had been the first. "I remember him like that," Sarah said softly, gripping her husband's arm. "So do I," whispered back Don. "That was how I first saw him." "Yes," she said. "I could see him like that in my mind's eye, like it was yesterday. That is how he will always be in my heart, in my mind. Never an old man. But John Corbett, by God, Morgan. Even as a child I could see that this very name struck terror into all the people around me. At least the others, those who were not of the party. And so it should have been. Tall and overwhelming, unbelievably strong and powerful, the muscles of his chest and arms nearly splitting his t-shirt. That was Dad, the green man of the wood, the god personified, just as my mother was the goddess. There was hate and love in him that awed me, little girl though I was, because I sensed that it was something magical, something primal. Love for me and my mother, terrible hate against those who would hurt us. And when I was little, I was always so afraid for my father when he was out in the mountains, knowing that the whole world was trying to destroy him, to take him from me. But somehow, I always felt he was there with me, watching over me. I feel it still. Now he watches over us all. There was another face on one of the posters, a thickest, red-haired man with a flat face and cold green eyes like ice. Everyone saw the mugshot on the poster, and no one commented on it, but it gave Don pause. "Hmm," said Don, casting a careful eye over the gathering. "What?" asked Sarah. "I don't see any Hayden Lake Flying Column men here," said Don. "There are at least 5 I know of, here in town and in Tacoma, who have just as much right to be here as the rest of us. Then there's Admiral David Leach. He's not here either. I wonder if Oglevy's people are having their own reunion, as usual." "They're probably in a trailer park, wherever the local meth lab is," said Sarah dryly. "I know it's legal now for the few who still feel the need, but I hear that little subculture of the Republic's population still likes the traditional home brew." Now, Snoops, racial unity and all that," chided Don. "I'm sorry, Don, but those guys scared me back then, and they scare me even today," admitted Sarah. "I know more than most that the Aryan race is capable of the most extreme violence of the many human species. However, we seem to lose the knack for a few generations back. But when it gets real and up close, I still freeze. I'm always afraid that Ava will bring home some boy whose father or grandfather rode with Oglevy. She'd be attracted to that kind, the strength and power, the rage and violence that so fascinates women. Oglevy mostly recruited from the native Northwesterners. That was one of the reasons he was so valuable to the Revolution. We called them woodchucks. Back in the South, they used to be called buckra men," said Don, soberly. "The lean, mean, poor whites who rode the slave patrols at night and kept racial order. Nowadays, those who were born here call themselves woodchucks with pride. Cindy did tonight. But it used to be a derogatory and contemptuous term, I'm sorry to say. Oglevy redeemed that term. He was born in this land, and he brought to his side those who were born here. And that was why he was so useful to us and so terrifying to Zog. They scared Zog then, and their descendants scare Zog even today," said Don, soberly. "I wish we hadn't still the need for men like that, Snoops. Maybe one day we won't. But until the world changes and accepts the right of our people and our nation to be here on this earth, there will always be work for the guys and gals with the tattoos who come out of those trailer parks. These who are with us here tonight are the best from that time," said Sarah. "Oh, geez, Snoops, I don't want to mess it up for them," whispered Don dismally to Sarah. "Suppose I find out that the Olympic Flying Column legend isn't true. Don, do you remember one of the old man's axioms that they teach our kids in school?" replied Sarah. "The one about the truth being an absolute value? That's what is true must always, in the long run, be good, and what is not true can never in the end be good?" "I remember," said Don. "Snoops, one day, many years from now, you and I will come to one of these gigs, and we will be the only ones here. We were the youngest. That means that we may well be the last to depart, the last to enter the Hall of Valhalla. How will we bear it?" "We will bear it because it is the destiny that the gods have given us," said his wife. "Don, tomorrow you will do your duty to this country and this people, as you have done all your life. Tonight, don't worry about it." Don felt a tap on his shoulder. "Good day, mate," said Charlie Randall, grinning and shaking Don's hand. Randall was a tall and weather-beaten-looking man of 60-something. Even on a cool northwestern autumn night, he still affected an Australian safari suit. "Hey there, Charlie. Snoops, I needed to natter with Charlie a bit," said Don. "Can I trust you with this horde of ancient satires? Just dancing. I'm not going to come back out here and catch you in flagrante delicto now." You know the Republic's law gives me the right to plug you both if I do. Hey, you won't have to, laughed Sarah. If I even offered and flashed them a bit of this alabaster bosom, they'd drop dead of a heart attack. I'll make note of that, Sarah, in case we ever needs to whack one of these geezers for reasons of state, replied Charlie, with a grin. Quiet, clean, and untraceable. After some preliminary socializing, Randall and Don Redmond got together in a closed-off private room next to the main reception area. Outside, increasingly drunken old vets of the NVA were whooping it up. The band called themselves the Domestic Terrorists, and they specialized in Northwest Rebel songs, the ones based on the old bluegrass and Appalachian ballads, and also on old Irish songs from the Provo period and earlier. There were six musicians with various combos of banjo, guitar, fiddle, slap bass, bass mandola, and tin whistle. Their audience's enthusiasm was fueled by copious quantities of Red Hook, Henry Weinhard Ale, and the Olympic Club's famous microbrew, along with the generous shots of Old Log Cabin bourbon. The air was blue with tobacco, both smuggled and domestic product of the hydroponic gardens of the state monopoly. "So what can I help you with, Don?" asked Randall. "Just want to pick your brains about some ancient history, Charlie," Don told him. "How ancient? Want me to tell you the old Abo legends about Ayers Rock?" "No, a little bit more recent. You were a hunter for a long time, weren't you?"
"Almost 10 years after the revolution, before they kicked me arse upstairs to this bloody desk job."
Redmond's question was rhetorical. He knew that Randall had successfully carried out assignments as far afield as the UK and in Australia. Randall was Chief Operations Officer for the War Prevention Bureau, and the man largely responsible for ensuring that hostile elements within the U.S. and the U.N. power structure never succeeded in building up the necessary critical mass in military capability, political will, or propaganda frenzy to launch a bona fide war of extermination against the NAR. The main tool for accomplishing this objective of state was the use of carefully targeted surgical assassination. Intelligence agents, psychological profilers, political scientists identified those relatively minor personalities within the U.S. who might not make trouble now, but were likely to develop the capacity to be dangerous to the Republic in 5 or 10 years. The hunters removed those people on the sound principle that baby rattlesnakes tend to grow into large and venomous rattlesnakes. Politicians, community leaders, media people, Hollywood gurus, religious leaders, government officials, writers and intelligentsia, and the entire necessary propaganda and logistic infrastructure for launching a serious assault against the existence of the Northwest Republic was constantly being cut off at the knees. The result was that despite repeated efforts on the part of the world establishment to work their way up to a serious attempt on the Republic's life, it all somehow never seemed to gel. The War Prevention Bureau also had a special unit responsible for tracking down and punishing informers and traitors from the old days. That unit had shrunk over the years as virtually all such targets had been liquidated, but there were still a few accounts remaining to be settled. It was a national policy to hunt them down with the same zeal with which Zog had pursued veterans of the Third Reich well into their 90s. It was a vitally important message to send to the rest of the world. Betray the white race or conspire to harm the Northwest American Republic, and you spend the rest of your life looking over your shoulder, a life that was likely to be very short.
Struth! Best time of me life, that was, reminisced Randall. Over 50 kills with me own hands. I was in on hundreds more, one way or another. Everything from NVA traitors and informers to up-and-coming young blokes in suits we figured was going the wrong places. We drink to absent friends tonight. Well, there are some of our so-called friends from them days that bloody well deserve to be absent, and I made sure of it.
Why?
What's up?
I'm interested in one of our absent comrades in arms in particular, said Don. Ever chase Trudy Griner?
That she-devil traitor who sold out Tom Murdoch and Olympic Flying Column for $1 million?
For a while, yeah. Randall scowled.
She spent a long time at the top of our hit parade, believe you me. But she turned out to be the one who got away. Damn her eyes. What about her?
I caught a really odd one, Charlie.
One that goes back to the Olympic flying column days, if you can believe that, Redmond told him. I'll fill you in. But first, you were on the team that did Monkey Meat Coleman, right?
I was. Former Fatpo Major Coleman was only blackfella who ever raided a special hunt of his own. We brought the whole carcass back and stuffed it. He's down in storage in our basement in Lacey. One of these days we'll figure out some special propaganda event and trot him out on display.
What about him?
I don't mind talking about that one to you, Don. Never was one for all this interdepartmental territorial crap. Just so long as you bear in mind it's still under the Official Secrets Act and keep all shut 'em.
Corby Morgan himself laid this job on me, so it's all good.
Charlie, before you killed him, did Coleman ever give you any idea what went down with the Olympic flying column? Who was the informer might have been?
We know who the informer was, said Randall, in surprise. Trudy Bloody Griner. But in point of fact, yes, we were instructed to have a quiet word of prayer with Monkey Meat on that subject before we sent him on his way, just to dot the I's and cross the T's.
And? Prompted Redmond. Randall looked embarrassed.
Never got the chance. Work accident. Beg pardon?
We caught up with Monkey Meat in Detroit. It was a so-called promoter after he got out to Fatty. Ran a couple of nigger boxers and rappers, that kind of crap. What he really was a dope dealer and pimp who moved drugs and girls through a couple of nightclubs. Do you want the whole thing play by play?
No, I'm only interested in the Ravenhill business, said Don.
Good, makes a long story a lot shorter. Coleman knew we were after him, and he took precautions. We had to set a honey trap for him. Used one of our female hunters to lure him away from his entourage. It's somebody you may know. She's married now with kids, and I don't see any need to remind her of that part of her life unless it's necessary.
It's not, said Don, shaking his head.
Randall continued. Well, we got Monkey Meat into a trunk of his own pimpmobile Cadillac all nice and trussed up, gagged with a towel, and we drove him off to a nice quiet spot for our little come-to-Jesus session. We got where we was going, popped open the trunk, and the monkoid's already dead. He knew right well what was coming, and he was so terrified he puked, but he couldn't because of the gag, and he ended up choking to death on his own vomit. We were definitely going to ask him about Trudy Griner. We hoped, against hope, that he might have some idea where she was, and he'd try and trade that information for his own worthless life, but it never had the chance to play out.
In your professional opinion, why, exactly, were we never able to catch up with that little lady? Asked Redmond, over the babble of the crowded barroom next door.
You guys are damn good, and that's a fact. You're right, she is our official one that got away.
But I'm curious as to why. In view of what she did, surely you pulled out all the stops.
Too bloody well right we did, replied Randall, with a scowl and a muttered curse. That bitch is slippery as a bloody eel. It became a point of honor with us that one day we'd catch up with Trude, but we never did. Back when I was first with the Bureau, I once spent 2 months in the living hell of a Houston summer trying to find her. Just before that worse bitch, Chelsea, finally handed the city over to Aztlan. I finally thought I had her, and we moved in for the kill. But something tipped her off. We missed her by about 30 bloody minutes. Signs of a hurried packing and her bloody supper was still warm on the table. God alone knows what spooked her. I still get angry thinking about that. For years she managed to evade us. Then about 10 years ago, we were told to stop looking.
What? Asked Redmond, in astonishment. Who the hell ordered you to stop looking?
I made it a point to find out, said Randall, evenly. It was the old man himself.
You're joking, gasped Redmond.
Does me ruggedly handsome antipodium countenance betray the slightest sign of jocularity, my son?
No. We were pulled off the Trudy hunt by the then state president, Patrick Brennan. I was able to learn that this was done at the personal request of the old man.
Did he ever give any reason? Asked Redmond.
Brennan, I mean.
None that I was ever able to get out of him, and believe me, I asked. Unfortunately, he's dead now and can't speak, and I was never offered the opportunity to speak with the old man. He was pretty much sequestered even a decade ago.
officially to protect his privacy during his golden years and all that wallaby whoop, but unofficially to keep him from doing anything in public that might prove embarrassing. From what I gather, he's pretty much senile now. The party used to trot him out on formal occasions, like a kind of stuffed dummy, but not for a long time now. I think they're worried he's gone so far he'll drop his trousers and wave his John Thomas at the audience. Even if you could get to him to ask him, he may not even remember what he did or why the hell he did it. I'm not surprised. The old codger is 100 and what now? Asked Redmond. He was born in 1953. You do the math, said Randall. 1953? Whispered Don in awe. Holy Jesus! Is such a thing even possible? Look, I know we have the best health service in the world, and that we've made medical discoveries that have put us decades ahead of everyone else. Hell, cancer cures in our hospitals are one of our main foreign currency earners. When little Brandon or Jennifer has leukemia, all of a sudden us evil Nazis ain't quite so evil. But still, it seems astounding to me that someone could live that long. Ye gods, think of what memories that man must have. Most of those memories are probably a curse to him now. The world he knew is gone forever, for better or for ill. That isn't something that should happen to anyone. No man should live too long past his time. I don't envy him. You always were obsessed with the past, said Randall, with a laugh. You should have been a history teacher, not a cop.
Those who refuse to learn from the past are doomed to repeat it, replied Redmond.
Yeah, so they tell me. Anyway, if you chance to get an opportunity to speak with the old man, for Christ's sake or Odin's, please ask him why he gave that order. I really would love to know, said Randall.
Behind them arose shouts from the elderly audience demanding, insistent.
Rabble song! Rabble song! The old codgers yelled. Are yees all drunk enough? Yelled the band leader into the mic in the ballroom outside. There was a chorus in the affirmative.
Then I guess it's time for a rabble song! The cheers resounded as the banjos and guitars struck up an old favorite.
It was on a January eve, as the sun was going clown, when a truckload full of volunteers approached a northwest town. The stars were bright and cold of night, it chilled them to the bone, and their leader was a Texas man, Jack Smith from San Antone.
Let me ask you something, Charlie, said Redmond. That time in Houston when you thought you had Trudy Griner, where was she living? What kind of place?
Ratty little bungalow in Baytown, it was, replied Randall. She was working as a cashier in a megamart. We found her by hacking into the federal ID card database and doing a holographic comparison on her facial features. She dyed her hair and had some kind of plastic surgery, but we still made a 12-point match on a Rosa Lee Johnson in Houston and took it from there.
Why?
I guess she wasn't able to hold on to the $1 million she was paid for her ratting out the Olympic flying column then.
Hey, when you got to keep moving from place to place one step ahead of the hunters, $1 million can disappear pretty quick, said Randall.
Maybe, replied Don, or maybe she never had the money to begin with.
Seems kind of odd, is all.
I'm trained to look for odd things. How could a woman with $1 million in her poke end up working as a cashier in a megamart? I sense a certain incongruity there.
Maybe she gambled it all away in some Indian casino.
Look, Don, why the questions? Do you know something? Asked Randall keenly. Has Boss finally gotten a line on that Griner woman that I haven't heard about?
In a way, yeah. I've been handed a pretty weird assignment, Charlie.
How's your own Official Secrets Act these days?
Got it off by heart, said Randall.
Trudy Griner's coming out of hiding.
Or, so she tells us.
Going to walk right across the border into our arms on the 22nd to add insult to injury. Says she's innocent.
Randall whistled. You don't say.
I just did say.
Or rather, she says.
We got a letter from her with a bloody thumbprint to authenticate it. Says she's coming home and she wants a trial. Public trial to clear her name. She denies that she betrayed the column.
If she's right, we're going to have to rewrite a lot of our history textbooks, and those new editions will be heavily stained with the egg dripping from our faces.
She claims she's innocent, demanded Randall. indignant and dumbfounded. "That bloody cheek of her! That's impossible! We know she did a flit with $1 million the day after Ravenhill. So what is she going to say about that? Tell us her Aunt Millie died and she inherited all that lolly and decided to take a vacation right on the morning of her entire unit is slaughtered? You can't... Do you? You can't think she's innocent." "I am investigating the possibility that she just may be," said Redmond. "I'm also supposed to be dotting the I's and crossing the T's in a manner of speaking, but I'm already finding some oddities. As to the facts of the matter, I always start with an open mind. Who knows? She may yet get her trial, courtesy of the information I dig up. I may yet prove that she's guilty of sin. But the can of worms has been opened, Charlie, and when one does that, the worms crawl out and things can get kind of squishy." From the ballroom, the words of the rebel song came loud and clear, the audience singing along lustily. "And the dark they moved along the street, up to the jailhouse door. They scorned the danger they would face, what fate might lay in store. They were fighting for their people's right to make themselves a home, and foremost of that gallant band was Smith from San Antone." "You know, John Corbett told me once that he knew Jack Smith," remarked Redmond. "Yeah?" asked Randall, interested. "Never met him myself. I never got out of Montana way back in them days." "Yeah," continued Redmond. "John C. said that for all his faults, Jack Smith was the best man with a gun he ever knew. He told me Smith had two outstanding features. The man was as brave as a lion, and he thought maybe 10 minutes ahead on a good day. He played it all by ear, and he had the devil's own luck for a long time. Smith was a boozer. Gunpowder and alcohol don't mix, but for a long time his luck held. During the first couple of years, Jack Smith was personally responsible for just about all the federal body count in Montana. He had a very simple philosophy of life. Kill the enemies of the white race. He got by on sheer raw guts, shot it out with a team of 6 FBI agents in Kalispell, and killed every one of them. The party made the not uncommon mistake of confusing personal courage with leadership, and so they made him a commandant. Wrong move, but in those days, brave white men were in short supply. Then his luck ran out. That particular operation they're singing about in there wasn't betrayed, at least not in the dramatic sense. Smith simply didn't have enough discipline or sense to tell his kids not to go into combat drunk or to put their guns away and not fire into passing houses as they went into town. Some pale-faced stukach called the cops on them when he saw 4 or 5 vehicles of armed men rolling by, hollering rebel yells and shooting out mailboxes. "Well, at least it's a great song," pointed out Randall. "Yeah, he gave us that," agreed Redmond. "And it was worth it, I wonder. 2 dead white men and 12 more in prison for a great song? You know damn well it was," replied Randall. "That great song and 100 more like it helped make this country, Don. There are times when a man must give his life for a song, quite literally. The Irish learned that many centuries ago, and were able to learn it faster than that, thanks to the old man. It was his idea to cannibalize and rewrite all those old Irish rebel songs. Now they're a part of our heritage. But their daring plan had been betrayed, the fatpos lay in wait, and 100 guns poured down that street, a hail of death and hate. When the shots had died away, 2 men lay as cold as stone. There was 1 kid from Wisconsin and 1 from San Antone." "You used to be pretty good with a gun yourself during the revolt," said Don. "Yep, that was when I got my start hunting. Acquired a taste for it," chuckled the old assassin. "Nothing like a dead Jew lying on the floor with his brains oozing out to give you that solid feeling while you're accomplishing something in life. Makes it all seem worthwhile, know what I mean?" "Didn't they call you the Prince of Wands?" asked Redmond. "That was my media nickname, yeah, but I encouraged it," Randall told him. "You know about the tarot cards?" "My wife is a witch," Redmond reminded him. "She does a reading for me once a week. The whole family, in fact. Cindy L. on Monday, Alan on Tuesday, Matt on Wednesday, Ava on Thursday, John on Friday, and me on Saturday. He does her own on Sunday, but she never says anything about what she sees." Right. Anyway, I would drop a Prince of Wands card on every dead body I manufactured. The media had a special case of the ass for me back then, since I specialized in taking out reporters and TV people who seemed to be unaware of the pressing need for balance in their reporting of the conflict. The old man declared reporters and media personnel to be enemy combatants and therefore legitimate military targets, said Don. Yeah, that was one of the smartest things we ever did. The old man knew that media people were essentially even more cowardly and detached to their wretched little lives than most middle Americans. Once they understood that they would be held personally responsible for the content of their reportage, and they, all of a sudden they got a hell of a lot more restrained, they would either see the party's point of view, or else they'd see me, and they bloody well didn't want to see me. Our team used to specialize in hunting down talking heads from the Sunday morning cable shows, who made a career of bad-mouthing the NVA and white people in general. That was interesting work. Took us all over the empire, New York and L.A. and Atlanta. After a few of those talking heads ended up with their genitalia stuffed in their mouths and a Prince of Wands on their schnoz, all of a sudden the Sunday morning cable discourse assumed a much more reasonable tone. We really threw a monkey wrench into the Zionist propaganda machine. Their media flacks were all too scared to do their job of spreading hatred and lies. I think it could honestly be said that Longview was made possible because we stopped those swine from keeping the pot stirred to fever heat. That allowed the peace movement to grow in the States and eventually gave Bush the Fourth enough slack so he could sign the treaty. Anything else, Don? No, said Don. I guess I'd better get back there and rescue Sarah from that horde of geriatric Lotharios before she gets pissed off at one of them and turns them into a toad. From the main ballroom came the rousing final chorus. The Lone Star State has lost a son of courage and of pride. Where he fell beneath Montana's sky, brave foreman by his side. They've gone to join that gallant band who held the Alamo. A dying fame surrounds his name, Jack Smith from San Antone.